previously on Popping Collars.
Just been, I mean, it's the beginning of the school year, so I've been talking all about Genesis and the two creation stories with my sophomores, and it's just, it's such a difference between the two stories.
Wait, and they're how, creation stories?
Wait, hold on.
You're blowing my mind, Betsy.
Hold on, I'm blowing your mind. There might even be multiple sources in the Bible. I'm just going to throw it out there. It might not all be Moses in the first five books. Boom! That just happened.
Church comes with its own issues.
Yes.
People knowing when you're home.
I totally eyes cleared out enough that I can hide the car as it's very old.
Yeah. Okay. Well, welcome to Popping Collars, gentlemen. My name is Greg Knight. I'm a veteran of Popping Collars now, having done this every time, and will continue doing this every time as long as I have the recording equipment, recording software on my computer. With us is back again from the first show, Chris Arnold. Say hello, Chris.
I'm resurrected. I am indeed the Reverend Chris Arnold, calling from Emporia, Kansas, in the heartland of this great nation.
And a newbie to the show, and actually our second foray out of the Episcopal world, Presbyterian minister and stepbrother to yours truly, Kyle Goodman. Welcome, Kyle. Say hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So the topic today is Doctor Who, and we could go on and on about the virtues of Doctor Who. Who? Don't get us sued. who hasn't said all the superlatives that come along with the show? You're talking about a franchise now that's existed in some capacity for 50 years. What other British enterprise can you say that about besides James Bond?
It is the longest.
It's got some legs.
Longest running sci-fi show in the world, if I'm not mistaken. 1963 to the present day.
A source of patriotism for the UKers.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Chris?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was born, dear listeners, I was born in Newcastle up in the Northeast. You can't tell from the accent. But no, this was part of my indoctrination from my parents growing up. I watched, you know, Tom Baker and all the every doctor from that point onwards, and it was, you know, it was part of my my national identity growing up. So that blue box is that's my heritage right there.
the Queen and the Doctor.
Queen and the Doctor.
Yeah. British patriotism. So it's for the purpose of this conversation, we're going to be talking New Who, mm-hmm. as it has been described. So that's the relaunch of the show, following the it wasn't a mini series. It was a made for TV movie, The Eighth Doctor. And then was, launched again in 2005 with, Christopher Eccleston, taking the role of the Doctor for that year. And then of course moving to David Tennant in the role of the Doctor, and then finally to Matt Smith in the role of the Doctor. So for our conversation, we're going to be talking about the relaunch of the show, with Christopher Eggleston, and we will go as far as the Day of the Doctor, which was the special, the 50th anniversary special that kind of tied together a lot of the history of Doctor Who. And we will not be getting into the more recent episodes that have launched. So spoilers for those of you who haven't seen the show, but not spoilers for people who are still continuing to watch the show.
Yes, if you, dear listeners, if you have never before seen The Doctor, All you have to do is go back and watch about 400 episodes and then hit play again and get caught up with where we are. We'll wait.
That's all. Yeah. That's all. So the Doctor, as he comes back to us in 2005, what's the best way to describe his personality? He is not the quirky Doctor that maybe people remember from the 80s with the long scarves and the colorful outfits, not the absent-minded Professor Doctor that has existed before in the past. This is a Doctor for the modern day, who seems to be pretty aggressive, who seems to have a harder side to him than you would sort of expect from this character. Not the sort of lithe Doctor you may have come to know from the classic series. Yeah. What we learn over the course of the next, what, this started in 2005 mm-hmm. and kind of wrapped up in 2013, what you learn over the course of those 8 years is that this is a Doctor very troubled. One that has a secret from his past that has left him as the only Time Lord in the galaxy, the only one of his species left in the world, and he bears some responsibility for that. And so you get the sense that this is a Doctor who still has moments of escape, but is carrying a large weight on his shoulders throughout most of the series. The actors address this in different ways, but I think that feeling of responsibility and that feeling of weight exists at the core of all three of the new Doctors. And I'm wondering if we can pick out some stories here. Maybe we can get a sense of who the Doctor is. That's the question, right? Who is this Doctor?
Biggest question in the universe. Doctor Who?
You know, I don't know if this is a good way to start off the conversation, but I always think that what the Doctor is kind of a better question than who the Doctor is. You know, when the Doctor introduces himself, he always introduces himself as the Doctor. And the closest thing that I can kind of find to that introduction is the introduction of the burning bush and this, I am who I am.
Or I will be who I will be. You're about to find out just who I am.
And that always leaves me with the question, with more of a question of what than a question of who. I'm wondering, how do you experience the Doctor when he kind of introduces himself to companions or possible relationships in this world?
I always feel like when he's introducing himself to a companion or a new character, it's almost like you're being caught up in the middle of a story. I love what you said about, you know, how the new Doctors, you know, these last three incarnations are, you know, in some sense different than all the ones that came before. And it's almost always like this Doctor has an agenda, a story that you're jumping into in the middle, and you barely have time to catch your breath, much less really figure out exactly what part this character is playing in the story or what part you as the companion are to play in the story. You're just along for the ride. And you jump in and jump out, and yet there's always this sense that something's happening apart from you as the companion, and of course the companions are really just those windows for the audience to understand what's going on in the greater story. We just sort of jump into the middle of what's happening in this very busy, very hurried, very, you know, all the time, you know, working something out kind of Doctor character.
Doctor, of course, I mean, that it's not actually a name, is it? It's a function. It's a job description. And, of course, we're all people who are talking on this podcast right now. It's Poppin' Collars. We're going to bring the religious perspective. It's about, like, you know, when I refer to Jesus as Christ, that's, you know, that's a functional title. That's not his name. It's a description of some particular sort of vocational role that he carries. So, you know, the doctor, by never actually telling anybody his name, I think what he's saying is that, you know, he keeps a part of his own personal identity held back, that for the companions, for his enemies, for the people who just run into him, what he needs them to know is that insofar as he's interacting with them, he's going to be doing something doctor-like. Now, what is that? Is that teaching? Or is that like PhD doctor dropping science on him? Or is it healing? Or a little bit of both? So it's, you know, it's a function. So what role does the doctor play within the lives of the people that he interacts? And what does he hold back?
Now, it's interesting, too, because doctor is a very specific title that carries a lot of weight, especially in the 20th century world. I've heard someone say, and I tend to agree, that in modernity, the doctor replaced the priest as far as the source of knowledge, the source of the voice of gravity, that you need to pay attention to this. You need to pay attention to what this person is saying, and for it to be the doctor, right? That's kind of this invitation, and not a subtle invitation of you should probably pay attention to what this person has to say for a modern audience. I think that where I find, and I'm going to kind of launch us into a particular story, where I found really my connection with this character for the first time was during the first season, the Eccleston years, you know, for the first few episodes, you're being reintroduced to the doctor. So he's in control, and he's taking his new companion, Rose, to the end of time and to the end of the earth. And, and he's in total control the entire time. And you have no sense that Rose is really in any danger necessarily, because this doctor is going to look out for her and is going to take care of her. It's in the episode when the Daleks are reintroduced. Well, when a Dalek is reintroduced, and we're told that this is the last Dalek, the one that somehow survived the destruction of all of the Daleks. It's this last machine, and it's tied up, it's chained up in a room, and the doctor is escorted into this room, and the door is locked behind him, and he's locked in this room with what has been his mortal enemy for years and years. And in that moment, he loses total control. He gives into his rage. He gives into his fear. He gives into every single thing that you wouldn't associate with the doctor that you had seen up to this point. And I love that moment, because all of a sudden, it's not the alien anymore. It's something that's a little bit closer to who we are that you see in that moment. And I think it's a powerful image, because I think that you start to see a glimpse that maybe things aren't quite as secure and as protected as we thought they were in this world.
Yeah, there's kind of the doctor. That's, I think that's the, what is it? The sixth episode. I just looked it up. It is the sixth episode in that first season. And there's been this feeling that, you know, the one who is rational and thoughtful, the one who thinks things through in a way that nobody else can, is the doctor. And then we wind up, you know, in this bizarre sort of museum of alien technology, and it's the humans who maintain the rational coolness. Meanwhile, the doctor is flipping out, but the humans are still making the worst decisions. That's the one where there's the collector, Henry Van Staten, who's been gathering all this alien technology and is, you know, for what reason is he gathering it all? But he stays cool, calm, and collected right up until the very end. But he's clearly crazy. But yeah, that's the first time that it's the Doctor who just loses it, and the humans just kind of stay cool.
It's interesting that both Stanton and the Dalek himself, you know, sort of reflect what we ultimately find out over the course of, you know, what those 7 seasons, 8 seasons, you know, what the Doctor is going through. You know, that Doctor sees the last Dalek, and he can't help but see the last Time Lord. He sees that insane human character who's collecting all these things that, of course, are reminding the Doctor of all the trauma that he's experienced. And, you know, over the course of those seasons, we come to find out just where that pain comes from the character. And that episode is sort of that first glimpse, as you point out, Greg, that first glimpse of the pain that we ultimately know this Doctor has experienced. And we don't really understand that until the end of the Matt Smith season, this last season.
So, Chris, what's an image of the Doctor that you find compelling or speaks to something about how you see his mission or how you understand kind of if there is a spiritual thread that runs through these stories, how kind of that conversation is set up?
Yeah, is there a spiritual thread?
That's a great question.
It is. I suspect that Stephen Moffat and I would have different answers on that. But it just, you know, what we see in that very first episode with the Daleks in the New Who, way back in the first season, reminded me of the first episode in the 7th season. We're up with Matt Smith at this point. It's the Asylum of the Daleks, it's called. It's where the Doctor and Amy and Rory are sort of sucked into this world. It's the first time, actually, that we meet Jen Louise Coleman, who, of course, is now the companion.
But the impossible girl.
Yeah, they're sort of sucked into this world where the Daleks have dumped all of their, you know, the misfits, all the insane and crazy and misshapen and all the projects gone wrong. And they've been brought there, they've been kidnapped and brought there by the Daleks so that they can destroy all of these, let's just say it, all the sort of disabled Daleks, you know, all the ones who don't fit into the perfect Dalek world. And that's the first time I think I became aware of some of the complexity of the Daleks. I grew up being terrified of Daleks. But I thought that the Daleks and the Cybermen were fairly interchangeable in that they were just, they were emotionless. That they were just sort of robots programmed to kill. And the Cybermen were, you know, the ones who could walk. And the Daleks were the ones who rolled around and had the little toilet plungers for hands. But that they were both devoid of any sort of emotion. And it's an Asylum of the Daleks where it becomes revealed that the reason why the Daleks have brought the Doctor and Amy and Rory to the planet to help them kill these disabled Daleks, or that the Daleks themselves cannot bring themselves to kill their brothers and sisters, no matter how corrupted they are, because the Daleks have this concept of beauty. And that blew my mind. It never occurred to me in all my years of watching Doctor Who that Daleks would have a concept of beauty. And so, and it's one of the things that one of the Daleks says, I can't remember the exact quote, but they say, you know, part of their concept of beauty is that they revere, they find beautiful, pure hatred. And maybe that's one reason why the Daleks have never been able to destroy the Doctor. That there's something of him that is pure hatred that they see, and they find him beautiful for it. So that was just mind-blowing for someone who grew up as a kid just, you know, assuming that Dalek equals exterminate.
Right.
That they actually have a sort of Augustinian aesthetic. You know, they find beauty within their world, and they desire, you know, they can't bring themselves to to destroy what is beautiful. So where do they get that idea of beauty? I mean, that's profound.
Right. Well, it's got to come out of their community. I mean, this is a big moment, I guess, for the Daleks, because they don't, you know, it's funny because over the course of the New Who, you kind of have to relearn the Daleks a little bit, and you're introduced to this one Dalek and you're like, okay, well, okay, I guess I kind of understand that guy. And then all of a sudden a bunch of Daleks just start coming out of the woodwork and you have to kind of figure out, okay, well, what's the hierarchy here? Like, who's in charge? Who's the, you know, what's the system that the Daleks have for themselves? And they try to answer that question through various ways, through, was it Davros, yeah. You know, and
the cult of Skaro.
That sort of crazy Dalek. Yeah, exactly.
The four Daleks who are sort of the bizarre sort of Jim Jones cult, Doomsday cult.
But the Asylum of the Daleks, I always thought was really great because it showed the Daleks as like an organism, as a community, kind of working together, and maybe that's why they were the most kind of understandable when you talk about your interpretation of their concept of beauty, because all of a sudden we're starting to get one voice lifted up from the community of the Daleks rather than these disparate crazy voices from the leaders of the Daleks the whole way. There's something about truth in community, I think, that comes across in that episode.
Yeah. And that's very,
and of course the Doctor, you know, it can be interpreted as sort of an ultimate loner, at this point, although has companions, but never has a community around him, certainly not in the New Who sense. So do you ever get the truth from the Doctor? I guess would be a good question.
Well, I mean, that's...
You get truth from the Daleks.
That's, you know, of course, surprise, surprise, bringing New Testament stuff into it. But it's one thing, especially in the Gospel of Mark, when I see Jesus' relation to his disciples... I very often see parallels in Jesus, in the Doctor's relationship to the companions, that he travels with them. They're intimately involved in each other's lives, yet there's always a gap of understanding, a gap of motivation, a gap of, you know, species. I mean, Rose and the Doctor clearly want to fall in love with each other, but they can't. Well, it feels to me that there's definitely, you know, a spark there. But that's never going to become, like, they're never going to settle down and have a couple of kids, you know. That's just not their story.
Kyle, where do you see sort of spiritual thread of the Doctor story going?
Well, the one that stuck out to me, and it's maybe not even my favorite episode, but it's... one of the more recent episodes, the Rings of Akhaten, where the newest companion, Clara, tells the Doctor, "I want to see something beautiful," and he takes her to this planet where there's this great religious gathering of folks singing this song to the old god, and there's this temple off in the distance orbiting this great, you know, explosive nova-like sun. And they go to this place of beauty and take part in this religious ritual. And of course, things go awry. The song is not sung properly. And before long, we find... the Doctor doing what the Doctor does, which is use wisdom and insight and this drive within him to make things right and to make things be at peace, to find a way to save those who have gathered for this ritual, and to calm this ancient old god, which turns out to be this sun, this planet-like body that has the potential of going on a Galactus-like rampage and destroying the you know, galaxy, I guess. The Doctor does that, and by, of course, doing his absolute best to give everything he's got, his whole self, his whole story. He gives that over to appease this this ancient old god, and it's not quite enough. But the companion Clara comes in with the end, with the save, bringing an offering of all the possibilities of a life now fully realized. But the spiritual thread, of course, for me is just this idea of trying to go see something beautiful, you know, to experience the beauty of creation, the wonder of the universe. And just like we creatures always do, we find ourselves, you know, in the situation where it goes to pot, where it's all gone awry. And we're in need of the save, in need of one to step in and heal us with wisdom and insight, with all their ability, and make it right. You know, for me, it's just it embodies that episode. What the Doctor always seems to be about, you know, every single one of their adventures seems like it starts with, you know, let's go see something interesting or something cool, or, you know, let's go on an adventure that probably doesn't really mean anything. And these companions, you know, they never seem to wise up to the idea that really they're on an adventure to save somebody else. You know, it almost sort of becomes the running joke in the series, doesn't it? That, you know, oh, we're just going to experience, you know, the culture that the universe has to offer. Oh, wait, someone's in trouble. We've got to step in and do some rescuing, some delivering, some saving.
Certainly the Matt Smith Doctor had to do a lot of saving. That's actually an interesting episode, because the one piece that I definitely remember is him down on that planet just shouting at the top of his lungs, you want me, you're going to have to take all of me. You're going to have to take it all. And this idea of sacrifice being a whole sacrifice, mm-hmm. sacrifice of his whole self, everything that has made him a Time Lord up to this point. That was gut-wrenching. That was sort of a gut-wrenching moment from that episode.
There's a lot of sacrifice in that episode.
Yeah. So another episode that it comes to mind that I always point to this episode as really the moment that I fell in love with this show and will continue to follow it no matter what to this point. You know, you always have that moment. Usually it's with a band. It's like a band will put out a song and you're like, well, that's the greatest song I've ever heard. I'm going to buy every single album they put out from now on, no matter what, no matter if it's just junk from here on out. Like, I'm totally in. I've bought in. Yeah, I've bought into Canadian pop rock.
apologies to any Canadian listeners out there. We love your offerings, except for Celine Dion.
But it's the John Smith episodes from David Tennant. It's when the Doctor becomes human. He becomes incarnate, right? He takes on a human form and takes on a new identity. He's no longer the Doctor. He is John Smith in order to hide out from this sort of band of aliens that's hunting him down.
Yes, and, the family of blood. They were
right.
They were creepy, especially there was that the one sort of the older boy who just had this look on his face all through.
Right, that sort of leer, yeah. That creepy smile.
So creepy.
Yeah. The things that I love about this episode, there are actually two things that I love about it. One is that we see the Doctor make another sacrifice. This time he's sacrificing his identity as the Doctor. He's becoming something else in order to do good, supposedly. But what we ultimately find in the story is that he's just hammering all the people that really love him. And I come back to this idea that Martha is really one of my favorite companions, his second companion after Rose, because she's in a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, she loves this Time Lord to death, and he will never reciprocate that love in a way that she will be satisfied with. And this is the episode where, I mean, it does horrible things to their relationship unknowingly, mm-hmm. Because he's under the guise of this human being. But he's, you know, he just breaks their relationship over and over again throughout this episode. And I always thought to myself, you know, this is a case of sacrifice without any kind of responsibility to what that sacrifice entails. Mm-hmm. It's like sacrificing at the cost of your family, at the cost of your loved ones. That always stood out to me. And then the other part is the final moments of those episodes. I think we see the Doctor as the ultimate evil of the universe. When he doles out the punishments, these hell-like punishments, to the family blood, and with no remorse, just stone-faced, just does terrible things to these creatures. And I came away from that episode thinking, oh my God, this guy is not to be mucked around with. This is not the character that I thought I was following. This is a character that's capable of serious damage. And that's something that you wouldn't necessarily associate with a doctor. Yeah.
That's interesting. You said no remorse, but I don't wonder if the remorse was not becoming the character of John Smith in the first place. I mean, the Doctor could have done this, all these horrible things to the family of blood from the outset. You know, the twist, of course, is really you think that the Doctor is running from the family of blood, and in fact, the Doctor is almost running from himself and what he knows he's going to have to do to these poor characters who think they're the ones with all the power and who think they're the ones who are out for blood. But really, you know, the Doctor knows the whole time how it's going to turn out for them. If he himself doesn't hide, you know, from them, he's not hiding from, you know, not hiding from them as much as he's hiding from being the one who's going to have to do that to those.
But that's not a savior, right? That's a judge. That's a very different role.
Yeah, but what do we have coming up in the gospel readings this upcoming week? It's something that I wrestle with, you know, as somebody who preaches every Sunday. Kyle, I don't know if you run into this as well. I'd like to imagine that Jesus is not judgmental, but again and again he says, you know, there's the sheep and the goats. There's the maidens who don't have their lamps lit and they don't come to the party. I don't know what to do with that, but maybe that's what's best for me, you know, in order to protect me from some of the predatory stuff that's out there for me. I mean, it's serious stuff that I don't think I can dismiss all that easily.
You know, I sat around a table tonight, a committee meeting, and I won't get into specifics, but we sat around that table having to make a decision that was no small thing for the family who had made that request. And the six of us that sat around that table understood that as we sat there, we were sitting in judgment of the request, at least. And you know, we sat there and we struggled and we talked about it and we talked about all the things that we wanted to say and do in this situation, all the ways we wanted to go to this family who had made the request and deny it for all the reasons that were good and right and proper. And at the end of that lament, we turned and said, well, now we have to just decide to do what's right. We have to decide to grant that request with the provisions that are necessary. And when I think of God as judge or Christ as judge, I have to picture it just that very way, that God does sit in judgment, but God sits in judgment just as we sat around the table tonight, saying to ourselves, we know who we're called to be and how we're called to love. And how we're called to care for the world. And even though we don't like what we're having to do, we do it because it's right. And we do it because it's just. And we do it out of love. And I think that's the kind of judge that our God is, a God who has to make judgments, but makes them out of love for the creation that God's made.
Kyle, you've just put me in the awkward position. It may be the first time in ages that I've agreed with a Presbyterian.
Just let us talk long enough, Chris.
Absolutely. No, I think you're right. It's if God wants us to be able to distinguish and to act on good and evil in our own lives, we can't just apply that to the little issues. Yeah. And it just gets harder when the issues, I mean, these things impact us because we love, and yet not everything that we love is the best thing. So that's where the self-sacrifice comes in. It's called Human Nature, is the second of the two episodes that we're talking about with John Smith, where the doctor becomes this schoolmaster in 1913, this extra layer on there. You know, that episode, I think, came out in 2013, so 100 years later, right? I don't know if that's if that's true. We can look it up. But around about the 100th anniversary of you know, Britain's entry into World War One, the start of World War One. You know, that was a time when all these young men, without really knowing what it was that they were going to, bravely marched off to war. And at the same time, you have this episode that is about the doctor bravely giving up his own power and self-awareness and becoming somebody that he is not. I mean, it's... I'm not the only person to notice that it bears a similarity to the kenotic hymn in Philippians 2, you know, that where Christ emptied himself and took the form of a slave. You know, is that what we're seeing there in that episode? And is that what it was like to be God at the, you know, present at the beginning of the world and speaking creation into existence, and then to wind up as a 12-year-old boy, you know, scared and wandering around the temple?
The end of that hymn, though, of course, is that, you know, every knee will bow and every tongue confess, and we see that reflection in the doctor at the end of that episode, one to whom, if all things being equal, there's none in the universe that can best it. Well, I'll bring up one of my favorites, which is the Angels Take Manhattan. I just love the Whispering Angels to begin with. But that episode where the audience is facing what it knows will be the goodbye to Amy and Rory, which I think in some really interesting cultural ways had... As much as Rose was beloved, I think that a whole new audience had discovered the show by the time we get to the seasons with Matt Smith and Amelia Pond and Rory. And we find ourselves, you know, those of us who binged watched everything on Netflix, you know, and are now caught up and are watching the show as it comes, you know, sort of facing in real time that the weight of the goodbye to those characters that we've committed ourselves to. And I think the show did a wonderful job nodding to that, you know, that anxiety and apprehension of having to let go and say goodbye with this episode that sort of caused us to take note what it means to say goodbye and what it means to face the grief of that, the feeling of loss and hurt. You know, throughout that episode, the doctor is, you know, reading this book, and this book is actually an account of what's happening in the episode. So the more the doctor reads of the book, the more things become real. And soon the doctor realizes that, you know, things are becoming real for him in a way that he can't control. He can't put his, you know, finger on and stop. And we work our way toward the end of that episode where, you know, at all costs, the doctor doesn't want, you know, the characters to look and see the names on the tombstones, because ultimately that's what's going to make their deaths real. And if they read the tombstones, you know, that means it actually happened, and it's locked in. And no matter what timey-wimey shenanigans go on, it's locked in. It's an event that can't be changed. And we walk with those characters right up to the end of that episode, and we realize that no matter how much we would like to be able to avoid the inevitability of loss, of death, you know, of having to say goodbye, it's a reality that we cannot escape, not even if we have a time machine and can go back and try to change things. It's a reality that for all of us is locked in. And I find myself in my ministry with people, particularly those who are facing, you know, facing death, family members who are caring for aged loved ones. You know, I did it today, you know, just in conversation, walking with people and having them come to some greater understanding of the inevitability, the certainty, and even the appropriateness of that loss, of that break, that moment of saying goodbye. I think people in our congregations have a more and more difficult time with that. I think we're very disconnected with the reality of death. You know, we're living longer, and, you know, we push those things to the margins. They're perhaps not always at the center of our faith communities anymore. And I just really appreciate a medium like Doctor Who, you know, walking that difficult journey and doing so very intentionally.
I love timey-wimey shenanigans. I'm going to use that somewhere.
Write that down. That's going to show pop up in a sermon somewhere. I agree with you, Kyle. I think that the piece that I love about Amy Pond's exit is that she has to choose it. She chooses to turn around and look at the grave. And the thing is, it's not a choice for death for her. It's a choice to end her relationship with the doctor in order to have a life. And she's given this choice. And we see this choice come up in scripture, right? Choose life or choose death. And it looks like to the audience that she's chosen death by looking at the gravestone, when in fact that she's chosen a life that she can actually live on her terms with Rory moving forward. It's a really powerful image, and through the magic of the weeping angels, it's an image that exists in the span of what, 5 seconds? Yeah. Because it instantly transports you. Transports you away to another world.
Well, I can't remember, years ago I heard a sermon about that, you know, Deuteronomy, choose life or choose death, that even if you choose life, you'll still die.
Right.
But the question is how much of you will die before your body does. You know, will you die now and then your body will just kind of live some meaningless existence for the next 70 years, or you, you know, live right up until the time your heart stops beating. And I think, you know, at that moment, Amy chooses to, I guess, to embrace her full life without denial. I think she turns away from denial as she turns towards the gravestone. Which that comes up again and again in Doctor Who. There's this constant, you know, how many episodes do we have that are about fear, and then the resolution to the story comes when people are willing to face their fears and embrace the fact that it will mean more suffering.
You know, I think that Kyle said something really important at the very beginning of this conversation, which was, you're dropped into the middle of stories, and that's kind of how the Doctor's world exists. And I always thought that the David Tennant specials were great, because the way that they always started was that you would have this sense that you kind of understood how the world of the Doctor worked. Like, you understood the TARDIS, you understood how companions worked, you understood who the villains were a little bit, and then all of a sudden a boat would crash into the TARDIS in the middle of space.
Yes.
Or a woman in a wedding dress would just show up. And you would think to yourself, well, I thought I had this figured out, but now I'm not so sure. And that's what life, especially a life of hardship that the Doctor is living, I think that's what that is. It's when you desperately think that you're trying to sort of get it figured out, but you've never got it figured out. You've never got it really settled. There's always something that kind of pops up along the way. And that's the world of the Doctor, I think. What do you got?
I think that's interesting because I think that's a particularly 21st century struggle. And not that it's not true in other times and other eras, but I think my experience, particularly lately, has been that the world just moves so fast for people that the folks that I work with in my congregation, you know, it just seems like we're all the time just trying to catch up with what we know to be true and what we understand about the world. And about the time we've got it figured out, boom, something else just comes crashing in and the whole apple cart's upset and we have to go about the business of figuring it out, negotiating it again. And about the time maybe that's settled, you know, something else happens. And I very much feel like, you know, I'm pastoring a crowd of people, and I'm trying to shepherd a group that's just being beset on all sides by so many different things that are unpredictable and, you know, couldn't have hardly been imagined, perhaps, just a few years ago. I don't know what to do with that, but I definitely think the series mirrors in some way a very postmodern struggle to figure out who we are and what we're about when the world seems to change so quickly that about the time we have it figured out, we're dealing with a whole different set of things.
No, we've gotten very good at multitasking, but every one of the tasks that we take on in our lives have, you know, they call for reflection to try to wrap them in meaning, and they. Every one of those tasks has an emotional response. Not every single task. I mean, major ones that we wrestle with, but we don't leave ourselves enough time. I think for utilitarian purposes, to let each individual task have its own meaning, reflection time, and its own emotional safe space. We're constantly jumping from one thing to another so quickly that we just can't keep up with it. And so in order to do that, we don't have time to mourn the loss of that companion or to embrace the fact that the Doctor just had to make that really difficult decision with the Cybermen because, you know, the Titanic is crashing into that's how those episodes end. Like, just as I'm getting ready to come to terms with the fact that this episode is going to end with solemnity and sadness and with mourning, you know, the cliffhanger takes me in a completely different direction. And it really is kind of a perfect reflection of modern life. I think you're right, Kyle. It's very distracting.
Fragmenting. Isn't it interesting that's the way it is for a character who has lived for thousands of years, who perhaps ought to be able to get a little more perspective, and B, has a time machine literally all the time in the world.
Right. And yet can't maintain. He needs a doctor.
Yeah.
We all need a doctor. podcast here. It's time for some confessions. So with Doctor Who as our subject, we have each chosen our favorite Doctor Who villain that has existed in the New Who universe, and some of these villains have probably existed before then too. Who is your favorite Doctor Who villain, Kyle?
Well, I was going to say the Daleks, but we talked about the Daleks already.
We did.
So I'm going to pass on the Daleks and talk more about the Weeping Angels. Those threats, and you know, it doesn't necessarily seem like the evil, the terror of those creatures is all that bad. When they catch you, they send you back in time and eat up whatever it is, that energy that created. It doesn't necessarily seem like the most terrible threat in the world until you create some kind of elaborate time scenario that folks barely understand. But I love the horror element of those characters. You know, when you look, they're just stationary, and yet when you turn away, they're coming at you. And when the lights are out, they're coming at you. And the lights come on, and you see them, and they're just there. You know, we were just talking in the last segment about how the world comes at us and how we deal with the world. And you know, aren't they just a wonderful postmodern allegory for, you know, it's not the thing that we can see that gets us. It's the things all around us that we don't see that we're worried are going to overtake us at any moment.
Well, my favorite villain is almost akin to the Weeping Angels in a way, because it's this force, it's this kind of masked force that actually we are introduced to in the very first episode of the New Who universe. It's the Autons. It's these living plastic beings, and the ones that become sort of a real threat over the course of the very first episode are these mannequins that kind of come to life and start chasing after the shoppers that are in this mall that Rose is working at in the first episode. And the thing that I love about the Autons is that they are everything that is really great about the zombie story. Mm. You know, where we've gotten to in the age of, you know, The Walking Dead and modern horror in general is, well, you know, zombies are just these kind of gross things that sort of stumble around. When in reality, you know, the real horror of the zombie is that it's a mindless creature. It's a creature that has no soul, that just sort of pursues you because it doesn't have anything better to do. And that's what I kind of it's the only villain in the Doctor Who universe that's actually scared me. It's, you know, when they would convert people into, you know, these mindless creatures, by, you know, sort of oozing over them, or however it was that they kind of manipulated people. You know, it was the idea that you were no longer you. You had lost the anima that made you you, and were now this sort of mindless follower. I always thought that was just a horrifying thought. And so I was glad they were destroyed early. Who's your favorite villain, Chris?
Oh, well, so the Autons have actually shown up. You know, they go way back to John Pertwee, to the third Doctor, who was the very first Doctor that I remember seeing, actually, at a very early age. The Autons go all the way back there, and the Autons in that episode, it's also the first time that the Master shows up, and the Master was my pick, so this is actually a very twisted but elegant segue. It's elegant in my mind, at least. You know, the Doctor and the Master have this curious relationship all the way through the series, where they're the two remaining Gallifreyan Time Lords. But in a sense, the Master is sort of just the shadow side of the Doctor. And certainly, you know, before the hiatus, that's how it's presented. The Doctor is the good, noble person who is looking out for the well-being of the fragile species of the universe. Well, the Master is this self-centered, selfish, self-absorbed, you know, bitter younger brother who just wants to destroy everything and take all the glory for himself. And of course, then that becomes more complicated in the New Who, where we discover that the Doctor himself has this complicated personality. Sometimes he's just like a gleeful little kid, and sometimes he's, you know, without shedding a tear, sentencing the four remaining members of the family of blood to these horrible fates. So the Doctor has this complexity. So then what do you do with the Master? He can't just be the shadow side of the Doctor. And then, yeah, he does, you know, with the John Sim plays him in it's three episodes. Yeah. Utopia, The Sound of the Drums, and Last of the Time Lords. It's where he comes back as, Harold Saxon, Harry Saxon, and becomes elected as prime minister. And that wonderful storyline where the humans from way off in the future are brought back into the present time as the Toclophanes. These, you know, do you remember the human faces that are sealed in these little spheres? So, and of course, that's profoundly sort of religious, because in that last episode, in the Last of the Time Lords, it turns out Martha has been spent a year going around the world telling people the story of the Doctor. She becomes an evangelist of the gospel of the Doctor. And she, you know, what she tells them to do is, you know, at the right time, at this eschatological time moment, that they are essentially supposed to think of the word of the Doctor, which is, you know, a prayer. And they are to, when they do that, they will be overloading the network, the communications network that Saxon has set up, which is called Archangel. So, I mean, it's, it may be in retrospect, the most theological episode, the most nakedly theological episode. That is a single prayer of the race, of the human race, that winds up breaking the power of the Master.
So thanks a lot, guys. It's you know, it wouldn't be a pop culture podcast if we didn't talk about Doctor Who at some point. And so we've done our Doctor Who episode, so that's good. but from our unique perspective on Popping Collars. So we'll go into our last our final segment, our Go In Pieces segment. And this gives us a chance to say who we are, where we work, and ways that people can find us, either us personally or us, our churches and parishes. So Kyle, where are you and how can people find you?
Well, I'm in Statesville, North Carolina, Concord Presbyterian Church, not Concord, North Carolina. It confuses everyone. But a wonderful congregation, just a few miles outside of town, Presbyterian congregation, and thoroughly so. And I've served there for about 7 years and have loved every bit of it. And if you're looking for us on the web, you can find us at concordpreschurch.com, or you can find us on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter. I don't tweet. I'm a Presbyterian pastor. 140 characters is totally impossible for me, but Facebook I can do.
Chris, where can people find you?
I just see 45 minutes worth of tweets. You can find me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Father Christopher, FR_Christopher. And I blog and I post sermons at Father Christopher. And that's all written out, FATHER, Christopher.org. And, you know, if you want to see my parish, it's St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Emporia, Kansas. You know, you can find us via Google. But if you want some of me, Twitter and FatherChristopher.org. And that's about it.
And my name is Greg Knight. You can find me at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida, where it's still summertime, guys. I'm sorry. I know that. I know that it's going to be mean. It's really going to be mean in a couple of months when it's still going to be summertime. when the cold weather gets up to where you are. You can find us on the web at bbts.org if you're looking for our parish. Popping Collars is everywhere. You can tweet us at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook, Popping Collars Podcast. I think we are on Facebook. And you can email us, poppingcollarpodcast@gmail.com. And that's it for this episode, for the Doctor Who episode. We may have to do another Doctor Who episode because this is obviously a field that's ripe with for the harvest. But until next time, keep those collars popped. We'll see you on Popping Collars.
Peace. Wait.